And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. One of the great stories of North Carolina history took place right here under our noses. UNC professor James Lelutis and Duke professor Robert Korstad tell that story in their new book, To Right These Wrongs, The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. Jim Lelutis, a professor at the history professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, associate dean and director of the Johnson Center for Academic
Undergraduate Excellence,
is the co-author of the book, is a neighbor of ours and colleague in Chapel Hill, and has agreed to come visit with us about this book. Jim, you've had some practice lately talking about your book.
We've been on the road. Yeah.
Let me just start out by asking you, what have you learned? Because you have been talking to people who, although the 1960s and the War on Poverty and the North Carolina Fund are not part of the experience of many of your students and even your students' parents, there are some of us for whom those 1960s were critical times, and we remember them. So you've been out on the road talking about your book in the North Carolina Fund. What have you learned that you didn't know when you wrote the book, if anything? Or have reinforcing what you've
learned? Yeah, you know, I have to confess it was probably fate that I'd write this book, because I ended up meeting Lyndon Johnson when I was 8 years old in
Rocky
Mount. Is
that right? Did you? When he was touring to you've got a picture of him in North
Carolina.
That's
right. He came to Rocky Mount. The helicopter landed out near a sharecropper's home, and he spent the afternoon for a photo op.
Well, there's a great, this is, I just saw this photo in your book of sharecropper's family, a nuclear sort of picture of the family, and then surrounded by suits and coats and ties. So you've got the family, and then you've got the celebrities, and then you've got President Johnson and Senator Irvin maybe there. And it's a wonderful picture that probably leads into some of the things you could discuss about the conflicts among these various people and different expectations and hopes. Wow. So you were there.
So, I'm not sure how conscious I was of what I was attending at 8 years old, but I was there. It's been fun to get out and talk with folks about this book, both audiences full of people who may remember it in a personal way, and others, I think, pretty quickly understand the significance of this story for our own time. And the things we discovered, maybe we may want to talk in some detail about some of these, but I think they're lessons that are
timely. In a word or two, what is the message or the meaning of that experience for today? How does it ring?
I boil it down to two things. If we want to be serious about dealing with the problem of poverty in a society of affluence, we have to be serious about building democracy, and we have to tackle the challenges of racial reconciliation. I think at the end of the day, the book really boils down to those two key points.
How did I love that. I want to write that down. And that's sort of what happened with the North Carolina Fund. How did it get started?
Well, it got started in 1963. Terry Sanford, who had been elected governor in 1960, created the fund. It grew out of a kind of rediscovery of poverty in the late 50s, early 60s, amidst the post-war affluence in America. It also came out of the experience of Terry Sanford's generation, veterans, white and black, people like Terry Sanford, Bill Friday, whom we all know well, went off to war. They saw the human consequences of prejudice and bigotry and German and Japanese fascism, and they came home convinced that America had to change, and especially that the South had to change, that it had to change as a matter of moral principle. And Terry would have argued that if North Carolina, if the South, were really going to participate in the affluence of a sort of technological post-war society, that the region really had to be transformed. So there was an economic imperative as well.
Was this started in Terry Sanford's vision? Was this an anti-poverty effort? Was this an attack on the poor conditions of North Carolina people, or did he have in mind the sort of democratic revolution that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I think he had all those things in mind. It was about taking democracy seriously. It was about bringing new constituencies to the table. It was about civil rights and poverty and the ways in which those two in the history of this state had long been entangled, the welfare of African Americans and the welfare of many ordinary whites.
Talk to us about what North Carolina was like in 1963, in the sense that it was a different place than it is now, and you have to kind of understand some of the forces that were operating then so powerfully that have been swept away. But what challenges did the fund face?
Well, and I guess I pointed to two things. One, I'll give you some numbers to paint a picture of what the world looked like in 1960 when Terry was elected. About a third of all North Carolinians lived in poverty. A third. I mean, that's a staggering number. A half of all students left school before getting a high school diploma. About a fourth of all adults were functionally illiterate. And so you can see Terry's economic concern there. I mean, how to move a state forward in that way. And it's also, we have to remember, this is a pre-civil rights movement, North Carolina. And I think one of the things that Terry Sanford understood quite clearly, as I said, the ways in which the fate of black North Carolinians and poor white North Carolinians had really been entangled since the end of the 19th century.
So you had a lot of poverty, and you had the post-Reconstruction or post-Civil War race relations that had not been transformed by the Civil Rights Movement. One of the other things that startled me in looking back at those times was not just the high percentage of poverty, but the starkness of the poverty that existed then, so that if you compare with some of the poverty of today, as horrible as it is, it didn't approach some of the terrible poverty of the early 1960s.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's one of the challenges I have in the classroom teaching this, because my students, they have seen poverty, but not the kind of poverty, well, that you and I remember in some parts of the state that look more like the kinds of pictures we see today in the developing world.
Yeah.
My grandmother, maternal grandmother, was up in Perquimans County, still a very poor part of the state. And I remember going there in the summer. I mean, you saw children with distended bellies. I also remember my grandmother had a cow, not because she wanted a cow, but because she could afford one. And that's how the kids in the neighborhood had milk. You know, I think that's something else that's changed and sometimes is a challenge in the classroom. Our generation, even if we grew up comfortable, there was poverty somewhere in the family. It was not an abstraction. It was someone we knew.
Who was struggling a little bit.
We had to help.
We had to help a little bit.
But that's not true so much anymore. I mean, a lot of the students in my classes, they certainly feel for this issue, but they have a hard time making that personal connection. The poor are kind of an abstraction. They're those people on the other side of town, but often don't have a name, don't have a face.
Back in the early 1960s, what was the history of poverty-fighting efforts in our region and the other parts of the country, and how did the fund differ from those traditional efforts?
Well, of course, during the 1930s, Roosevelt's administration had identified the South as the nation's number one economic problem, and through a variety of New Deal agencies, there have been attempts to deal with that challenge. But many of those efforts were constrained, and they were constrained by local political opposition. I'll just back up and do a real quick little history lesson.
Yeah, good,
because
good.
What Bob Korstad and I would argue is the poverty in the mid-20th century North Carolina really came out of the political conflicts of the late 19th century, when both in the 1870s and the 1890s, broad political efforts built on an alliance between black and white voters to democratize the state's politics, to spread economic opportunity. Those efforts were defeated in vicious white supremacy movements. And after the disfranchise of black men in 1900 by constitutional amendment in North Carolina, you had a society built on white supremacy that held blacks at near subsistence levels of survival.
This is public, in part, public policy.
This is public policy, mm-hmm. absolutely. And by doing that, of course, devalued all labor, blunted dissent by encouraging whites to be concerned about racial privilege. And of course, what came out of that, once black men had been disfranchised, was in effect a one-party political system in which there was no legitimate arena for argument and debate. So when Terry Sanford took this on in the early 1960s, he was trying to work a very fundamental transformation, not only in this state's economy, but in its politics and social relationships as well.
We're visiting with Professor Jim Lalitis about his new book, along with Robert Korstad from Duke, To Right These Wrongs. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A new book, To Right These Wrongs, is a story of the North Carolina Fund. The subtitle of the book is The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in 1960s America. Amazingly, this book is a collegial project. Duke professor Robert Korstad and our own Carolina professor Jim Lalitis cooperated to do the book, and with photographs by our friend and neighbor Billy Barnes.
Billy Barnes is wonderful photographs.
They are terrific photographs and document better even than our discussion of some of the conditions and events that we'll talk about later. The pictures are worth a lot. We're talking about the start of the North Carolina Fund. And Jim, you talked a little bit about the historical background of the conditions that Terry Sanford faced in 1963 as he came towards the close of his term-limited time as governor. And so talk about the mechanics, because yeah. it wasn't just like you could snap your fingers and start something like this.
It was audacious. It's an extraordinary political story. I mean, we have to remember that Terry Sanford had won the Democratic primary in 1960 and then the general election. But sort of related to what I was saying earlier, it was the Democratic primary that mattered. And he had run against an arch white supremacist and a defender of Jim Crow, I. Beverly Lake. We also have to remember that at that time, the North Carolina governor, by virtue of the Constitution, had no veto, could only run for one term. So he was a lame duck the day, a minute after he was inaugurated. And by 1963, Terry was in pretty bad political shape. A lot of voters were unhappy with him because he had extended the sales tax to food, not because he thought that was the right thing to do, but because it was the only way he could get the legislature to give him more money for public education. And he and his wife, Margaret Rose, had sent their children to racially integrated schools in Raleigh. So out of this position of extraordinary political weakness and facing a hostile legislature that never would have signed on for this project, Terry just did an end run around them. He went to the Ford Foundation, and here in North Carolina, to Z. Smith Reynolds and Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundations, and raised $9.5 million.
What was his pitch? How did he pitch these foundations with his vision? Or because I guess some of these things were sort of an idea, ready to get funded, and responsive to the ideas of the funding agencies as well. But what did he sell? What was he selling?
Ford had been doing some of this kind of community development work elsewhere in the United States, and actually in parts of the developing world. That's the story historians haven't written, and that it's the connection between projects like this in the United States and similar kinds of projects at the same time elsewhere in the world. Sort of two answers to your question. One, Terry was very clever. The story is he went to New York and he met with the president of the Ford Foundation and he said, "I don't want your money. I just want your ideas."
I can hear him now.
And people who tell that story say, you know, he had picked their pockets in that one instance. He had wooed them. But he made the pitch largely about the importance of battling poverty in a democratic society and about the nation's future. I mean, think about it. A third of the population living in poverty. I mean, how do you build a prosperous future on that foundation?
I've wondered, and even after reading your book, wondered in the back of Terry Sanford's mind whether this was kind of, do-gooder is not the right word, but a traditional idea that there are poor people out there and we've got to figure out a way to help them better, or whether he had in mind the sort of empowering ideas of we're not just going to feed them and give them education and give them a good job. We're going to activate them as political forces. Did he have this in the back of mind, or did that develop as
it's really the latter. It developed, and I think at a personal level here, and I would say this about not only Terry Sanford but the director of the North Carolina Fund, George Esser. Both of them had that kind of courage I just described, and both of them were remarkably open to learning and changing. I mean, Terry Sanford began thinking education was the way to solve poverty problems, and he went out to schools around the state, black as well as white, which was unprecedented, and he was increasingly haunted by the inadequacy of what he was proposing. He looked in the eyes of those children and came to recognize that simply spending more on schools or giving them a little bit to eat, that wasn't enough. Same thing for George Esser. He worked primarily in municipal law.
George, by the way, a resident of Chapel Hill, part of the faculty at the then Institute of Government,
that's right,
and a friend of a lot of people who'll be listening to this, was the first and only director, executive
and they
director.
They both came at it in a kind of traditional top-down way. They initially thought that what the fund would be about is getting various anti-poverty agencies and communities around the state sitting down at the table together and figuring out how to deliver services more effectively and more efficiently. But as they got into this work and they really began to understand, particularly the political roots of poverty, they were transformed.
One of the things that you point out, that y'all point out in the book, is that early on there developed a notion that some of the control needed to be shared with the populations who were being served. And where did that idea come from, and then how did it develop and change as through the experience of the fund?
The idea bubbled up in sort of two places. It bubbled up inside the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington. It largely kind of came out of the sort of left tradition of organized labor. The CIO had been very important in shaping the early stages of the war on poverty. It also, though, came out.
I'm going to interrupt you, mm-hmm. and I really apologize.
Absolutely.
For doing that, because one of the themes that I was going to say is that we in North Carolina sort of taught those guys in Washington how to war on poverty, but you're telling me that there was some reciprocity, that we learned some things from them as well.
I think there was reciprocity, and there was a kind of resonance to develop. So, I mean, in part that concern for what was called maximum feasible participation of the poor was coming down to agencies like the North Carolina Fund, but it was also emerging out of experience as people were going into these communities and, in the most practical sense, watching local leaders stonewall. They were happy to have some of this foundation money or some of the federal money, but not if it was going to begin to sort of uproot the status quo.
We know how to do these things better in our community. Give us the money and don't bother us.
And don't bother us. And when the fund and the federal government came back and said, well, we are going to bother you. We are going to bother you, for one, by requiring that you serve black and white constituents equally. I mean, some of these communities just said, no, thank you. I mean, turned down, for example, Head Start money.
As a matter of conscience, we hear this today, as a matter of conscience, we will not accept your money if you insist on doing things that we consider in this community not to be in accordance with our traditions.
And, of course, the question there was, who constitutes we?
Who constitutes
the we? And so by 65, 66, the fund's leaders, people on the ground are beginning to understand the inadequacy of a top-down model, and understanding that really not much is going to change unless they begin to bring the poor themselves to the table, to be on the boards of these community development agencies, and to have a voice to be there when the social provision is divided up.
We're visiting with Professor Jim Lalitas about his book written with Duke Professor Robert Korstad, To Right These Wrongs, Story of the North Carolina Fund. He and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with UNC Professor Jim Lalitas about his book written with Duke Professor Robert Korstad, To Right These Wrongs. It's the story of the North Carolina Fund. And Jim, you've been great about describing some of the background, many more stories that we're leaving behind. But we're talking about the political enabling aspects of the fund's activities. Not all good. I mean, it didn't always work out perfectly. But I think great stories of North Carolina history, you mentioned before the break, is sort of the Northampton County, the Northeast North Carolina experience, where the government was in the control of, and the society in control of white people, white males, and the poor population to be served was largely, not altogether, but largely African American. And the conflict that developed as African-American recipients or the participants became empowered. Isn't that just as good a story as there is in the book?
And it's also a remarkable story about, you know, this point I was making, that willingness to learn and change.
Yeah.
The fund started off financing a community development agency there called the Chonoke Area Development Association, four-county program.
Up there in northeastern North Carolina, which is a place that many Chapel Hill people it's just kind of out there on the other end of the world. It might as well be in Africa or someplace.
Exactly right. To this day, one of the poorest parts of the state. But some of those counties, a third of all children are growing up in
Holland. Sort of say it's on the Virginia border, sort of on the way to the Outer Banks, mm-hmm. that you'll kind of come close to those counties.
It's known as North Carolina's Mississippi.
What happened?
For all the obvious reasons we're describing here.
Large black, this was large plantation black country, large black, and afterwards sharecropping, but very poor.
Very poor.
And a white elite.
And a white elite that, as I was saying earlier, really dug in its heels. For example, turned down Head Start money rather than have integrated classrooms. They were happy to have the federal anti-poverty money, but not if it meant that sort of change. By 1966, black leaders in that community had begun to organize. They organized themselves into something called the People's Program on Poverty. And you can imagine, you know, in Woodville, North Carolina, grandmother was. So I always say the wrong place. A meeting of 1,000 black sharecroppers in 1965, I mean, that was incendiary. The fund, recognizing the inadequacies of its top-down model, began to bankroll the People's Program on Poverty as a local opposition. So, in effect, what you had the fund doing was financing its own opposition. It had supported one agency and now was
supporting two,
a kind of insurgency.
Two organizations in what we would say creative conflict, but in conflict with each other in order to get the representatives of the population being served in the game.
That's right. And
now what was the result of this conflict?
Well, in the short term, the People's Program on Poverty was able to bring improvements to people's lives, the very basics of life, day-to-day life, clean water, a drinking water system, paved roads, access to schools, programs like Head Start. So in that sense, people's lives were distinctly better. In terms of a broader transformation of local politics, well, I think you'd have to say that that's still very much a project
Underway.
Underway.
But there are, in those counties, there are African-American county commissioners and some...
There are African-American county commissioners, so the county boards of commissioners, all sorts of agencies look very different, and that certainly has been a fundamentally important political transformation. But the battle against poverty there continues. I mean, it continues to be one of the poorest parts of the state, and you know that is because so much was left unresolved.
What about the tensions within the North Carolina Fund, its board of directors? I'm just thinking of a fairly liberal but still white dominated leadership of the fund itself. Did the experiences like this stretch their notions of what it took to be effective poverty fighters?
A few people dropped off that board as they went along, but again, I think the larger story is one of that kind of transformation. I think, for example, about Thomas Pearsall, a lawyer, large landowner in Rocky Mount. He had been the major architect of the Pearsall plan after the Brown decision, which, to make a long story short, was North Carolina's way of digging in its heels and sort of giving a nod to Brown, but finding ways not to implement it. Yet Thomas Pearsall was on that committee, and he was one of Sanford's and Esser's most consistent supporters as they made these tough decisions. And so it is an extraordinary story of most of the people on that board following Sanford and following Esser. By 1967-68, George Esser is raising money from the Episcopal Diocese in North Carolina to support Malcolm X University, and he has brought that board of directors along behind him.
It's an amazing story. Sanford's ability to make friends and then bring those friends along with the program based on the trust that they had in him is legendary throughout the state. But as I've read your book and talked to people about George Esser, he apparently had the same skill, which was not altogether converting people, but in terms of staying in communication, persuading his friends and supporters that he meant well and that he'd done his homework, that he brought people who wouldn't be natural or normal supporters of this plan of action to stay behind him.
And they both were masters at talking about this in multiple languages.
How do you mean?
He could go visit a local chamber of commerce, in a community like one of those counties we're talking about, where people are sort of generally hostile to the war on poverty, and convince them that their economic future was at stake here. He could, that afternoon, then be at a church meeting, appealing to people's sense of Christian duty, and making the moral case for these transformations. And they were both masters of sort of talking to people where they lived and where they stood, really understanding how to frame this in a way that, as you say, I might not convince you completely, but I could probably get you to come along by casting this and understanding how you thought about the world and figuring out how then to cast the story.
Another challenge close by to Chapel Hill was the experience of the fund in Durham, and I believe its headquarters might have been.
Its headquarters were in Durham. There was some talk of putting it in Chapel Hill, but that was a little too close to the university. And of course, you know, this was started in the same summer as the speaker ban.
Right.
Passed,
right. So. A whole different subject for a great program sometime, but. What interested me even more than the location of the offices in Durham was the experience in Durham. You've got one of Billy Barnes's great pictures of one of the dynamic leaders, African-American leaders, who started out as a community organizer, but wasn't totally appreciated by the Durham community. What was the experience of the fund in terms of the Durham operation or the Durham effort to any poverty?
Yeah, and you're talking about Howard Fuller, the appraisal of him was divided. You know, I would start a little bit earlier, though, and say the other person to remember in Durham is John Wheeler, who was president.
Who's an establishment Black Wall Street elite person.
And he was actually a close advisor to Terry Sanford before the founding of the fund and was on that board of directors. And when Ford made its final visit to North Carolina, their last visit was with Wheeler, and everyone made it pretty clear that Wheeler was going to have to say that he endorsed this. And if he didn't, Ford probably wasn't going to put the money on the table.
This is the Ford Foundation, and the significant early funder of the fund's operations.
But then to Howard Fuller, who came early in the life of the fund out of urban community organizing in the Midwest. Fuller came to Durham, and Fuller was a master. Again, he didn't talk in big, abstract political terms, but he went into communities, and he went door to door, and he asked people what their needs were.
This, you know, as much as anything else in the book, I should have learned this lesson a long time ago, but that all of these great, I would call them white ideas, great, really, wonderful ideas, and Howard Fuller to find out what really needed to be done and to mobilize and to get mobilized, just went, instead of working out of an office and handing out money or holding meetings, he went door to door to talk to people, and he both found out what people needed and he found people he could mobilize. Fundamental lesson, I guess.
It absolutely is, and I think you're so right. He went door to door, and he understood that was actually the key to effective mobilization. To come sit on your porch and say, DG, I'm not here to tell you what I can do for you. What do you need? You know, what are the concerns in your life? And of course, for the folks he was visiting with, it was the fact that the electricity didn't work and the bathtub had fallen through the rotten floor and the city council wouldn't enforce the building code and so on. And he found people, well, Ann Atwater, Ruby Gaddis, two figures are prominent in the story.
It was sort of like Jesus going by the Sea of Galilee, picking up disciples.
And Howard, you know, he helps Ann get her bathtub repaired and get the electricity fixed, and then brings her in on organizing local communities. And within about 18 months, Howard have organized people well enough that Ann is now precinct captain for the Democratic Party in her section of Durham.
All this is great and doesn't raise any conflict with me. But then we get into the arena of demonstrations and of the mobilization, in which there are real challenges, not just to individual power structure, but to the whole way we do things in this community. And that is an interesting part of
the
story.
It really came to a flashpoint when Howard and Ann and Ruby and others then began to show up at city council meetings, at housing authority meetings, and to challenge privilege and to challenge authority and yes, answer some very
So I'm a white
change.
Person in Durham, and I'm saying I was real excited about helping people fight poverty, but these are just a bunch of outside troublemakers coming in trying to breed discontent. They're not trying to fight poverty. They're trying to start they're just trying to cause trouble. I mean, wasn't there some of that reaction?
Yeah, and you know, that's an old narrative. And so when opponents told that story, well, that had been the story told ever since Reconstruction, actually. And it was about marginalizing those folks. And I think, you know, in North Carolina and even more broadly in American politics, this is still at play. The argument there was this is a zero-sum game. And if those people out there banging on the doors win, you lose. And that's why I say racial reconciliation is so important in fighting poverty, because what was important in the 60s for people to understand, this was probably the toughest challenge, and this had been a tough challenge throughout Southern history, for poor whites to understand that they actually had economic common cause with their African-American neighbors, and that this idea of a zero-sum game, that in fact exactly the opposite was true. So Howard Fuller and the fund got challenged in that way. Now, I have to say that what's really interesting in Durham is that a number of Durham's white elite came to Howard Fuller's defense. There were marches and demonstrations. And one charge was that Howard Fuller was provoking violence. Well, I think the fact of the matter is that the mayor in Durham called out very quickly the National Guard, up the ante, and Howard Fuller and Ben Ruffin did an extraordinary job of disciplining the protesters, making sure that they didn't, you know, cross the line. And many in Durham, even the powerful in Durham, actually argued back that Howard Fuller was the reason that Durham had not burned.
Yeah, no fires in the downtown shops.
So the critics, including the Durham newspapers on the front page, said another Newark threatened here. If you remember the Newark and Detroit riots in the summer of 1967, many others in Durham, out of the poor community, and as I said, within elite white circles, said no, we're not another Newark, and we're not another Newark because of Howard Fuller and Ben Ruffin.
The people who worked with him, who are still around, still view him as a great hero,
yes.
Howard Fuller.
Absolutely.
And do you agree with that?
Yes. I think Howard's, he's a source of real inspiration and understanding. I mean, he's gone on to work in the academy, so I think for people like me,
he's the perfect.
He's a nice role model. About how you apply what you're learning in scholarship and in the library, how you try to make that active in the real world.
One of the things that leapt out at me about Howard Fuller is the, as a community organizer, and you get a real notion of what goes on, is what our president's background. Doing some modern aspects of it, but that that in an earlier time you could have thought, well, maybe Howard Fuller would have been our first black president because he had these same sort of charisma and skills. We're talking with Jim. We can't see that, but Jim nodded.
I yes, think it, absolutely. All sorts of interesting connections to contemporary issues in politics.
Jim Lalitas is the co-author of To Right These Wrongs. It's the story of the North Carolina Fund, and he and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jim Lalitas. He is the co-author of To Right These Wrongs. It's the story of the North Carolina Fund and the battle to end poverty and inequality in 1960s America. And Jim, I've taken up all of your time, so many more things that I'd like to talk to you about. But what have we missed? What did you learn, and what do you think is the most important lesson that we can learn from your book and the experience of the fund?
Well, I think some of the answer to that is in where Bob and I are trying to take this now. We've just launched a new project, a three-year project, with the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke and in collaboration with the Center on Work, Poverty, and Opportunity here in UNC's Law School. We're calling it the Moral Challenges of Poverty and Inequality. And as we wrote this book, it struck us the degree to which a kind of moral language, a kind of normative conversation about poverty in a democratic society, to the degree to which that had really faded from the public debate and public conversation, that much of our talk and thought and policy has been shaped by behaviorist social science, which offers lots of important insights, but also in a way is limited. It's about the characteristics of the poor, the behaviors of the poor, and how to change those things. We have been really inspired by the fund to try to grab hold of a moral and ethical language. And so we're teaching a course together, and we're going to be doing some projects out all across the state. We'd like to see this book not just sit in the library, but actually do some work in the world. And we hope it can prompt a sort of reinvigorated public conversation about our obligations to one another as citizens in a democratic society.
Is the model of the North Carolina Fund one of the alternatives for fighting poverty today, or is it only a challenge that we must find modern ways of going after the same goal?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think history repeats itself, and that you can just pick up something from the past and translate it into the present. But I do think there are important lessons here. And one of the things that's really exciting for us is the degree to which our students are concerned with these issues. And the degree to which they're kind of hungry for this history. I mean, they're aware, they may be working on these issues today, but they're aware that they have little understanding that anybody else ever tried to tackle them. One of the most exciting things we did very early in this project was to pull together, with some of our students, to pull together a weekend conference in Durham for veterans of the North Carolina Fund. Students, some high school students, but mostly college students, interested in issues of poverty. Terry Sanford was still alive. He came and talked to them. Howard Fuller came and talked to them. And it was really about trying to create an intergenerational conversation. Wow. So I'd say that kind of ethical conversation and also across generational lines.
Well, thanks so much for the book, and pass on our thanks to your colleague, Bob Korstad. I want to mention one other thing about, we're not as good readers as we used to be. And as a part of the book that is published by UNC Press, there is a video, and the video is worth the price of the book.
Absolutely.
And it's if reading is a problem, buy the book. The video will be a part of it, and it'll be a great introduction to the kinds of things Jim has been talking to us about.
And I should give her a little plug here and some credit. A wonderful filmmaker in Durham, Rebecca Cerise. The film's called Change Comes Knocking, and
great.
She's done a remarkable story.
We'll have a link to the book on our website. Thanks, Jim Valitas, for your book and for your visit with us. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be right back here soon.